fact, if I get into bed and I don't have a book next to me and I start to read, I can't sleep.
Really? Well, I suppose that's a trained instinct after so many years. I find myself reading books mostly by people who would not themselves have written a book if they hadn't done something that was worth writing about. Because I think in as much as we're all like chipmunks gathering information from different sources, I think that sometimes I find fiction, the actual reading of fiction, to be something that's already processed. Nothing raw around the edges, already too filtered through. So I like to read partly for the research, especially for historical fiction. The research involves oftentimes being down in libraries, taking books off shelves that were last taken out before you were born, and things like that. There's a great sense of cracking things open again. But fiction itself, I think it's as important to stop working as it is to start. And I think at the end of the day, to work again on fiction is sometimes more than I can take.
But I found something about fiction that you can't duplicate well in nonfiction. If, say, you're reading a biography can usually tell you an awful lot about a person, but can't always tell you what the person really thinks, what the person really wants. And the fiction has a way of getting inside a person in a way that nonfiction does not. It can tell you the greater truth, I think.
I think that fiction has to find its genesis in nonfiction, and in that sense, the idea comes to someone who's writing like a grain of sand into a pearl, some sort of irritation which can't be gotten rid of. And as fiction has this reflex action is to wind fiction around it slowly, and as fiction layers itself around this spot of nonfiction, you lose track of where the nonfiction ends and where the fiction begins. And I think that's at the point when the fiction book, will take off.
Yeah, that makes sense. But you mentioned doing research and historical fiction. All of your books are historical novels, with the exception of A Calm at Sunset, Calm at Dawn. Isn't that true?
That's right. I think it's a process of organized obsession, in that you have to allow yourself to free fall into whatever subject matter catches you. I don't think there's no way to tell, at least for me, where the next idea is coming from. I don't feel bound by time. I don't feel bracketed by the need to write about my particular generation, by my particular age group. I find us linked much more thoroughly by emotions, and I think that I can read a story perhaps set with people who have lived and died before I was born, and I can find more connection with that than with anything that's happening in the present. So without putting boundaries on it, I do find myself often launching off into different parts of this century. And the nonfiction comes from just having, from setting things to rest. I worked on deep sea fishing boats when I was in college, trying to pay my way through, and for the longest time, well, the summers were these great, it was a great schizophrenic existence, packing up the books and the tweed jackets and the ties and going out on the fishing boats, and not just putting on one set of jeans and wearing them for 2 weeks. Nobody ever took showers. We were off about 100 miles near the continental shelf. And when I came back, the world was so separate. There was nothing to remind me of the world of being out on the water. And for the longest time, these things remained like a collage in my head. And the only way for me to galvanize them, to move on from them, was in fact to write them in a book. And that's what I've just done now with a book that'll be out next year, which is to do with being sent away to school in England, as I was as a young child. My father came over as a javelin thrower for the British Olympic team in the 1950s and stayed, but decided to send me back to schooling in England. So when I was 6 and a half, they put me on a plane. I remember my feet didn't touch the floor of the aircraft, and sent me to a little school called the Dragon School in Oxford. And from there I moved to a school called Eton, which is all draconian in its discipline. We wore, well, at Eton we wore bow ties, waistcoats and tailcoats every day of the year. And again, there's this sort of idea of a schizophrenic existence, because I went from the books to back to Rhode Island, where my father lived, and ran around without shoes on for months at a time.
That's very unusual, that your father made his decision to live in America and yet sent you back for schooling in England. There's almost an inconsistency there.
Indeed. I think that, well, he passed away when I was 12, so unfortunately, really, I'm only left to conjecture about why. But I think that he felt that if in Britain, if you're not born into a certain shift of society, you can't leave that shift. And he felt, as I think a lot of people do, that America, is a place of of great possibility. And yet, he had always felt done down by that kind of elite establishment in Britain, and there might be some bizarre form of revenge in sending your son to the core of the very establishment that he despised. And I kept diaries all through this time, partly for my father and partly for myself, and because he was very anxious to see how it was. And I packed away the diaries and only came back to them last year. And what I found when I was reading the diaries was that everything I had taken for granted was absent from the diaries. Everything that I remembered from the remembered nowadays was not in the diaries. What I remembered nowadays was everything I had taken for granted back then. And by that I mean the uniforms, the discipline, the fact that it was single sex from the age of 6 to 19. What was in the diaries was completely absent from my memories nowadays, and yet I would read those diaries and some memory would come rocketing down some alley in my memory as clearly as if it had just happened. And it made me remember that what they say about us being able only to use about a fifth of our minds and the rest of it being this great catacomb. Well, what it is, it's like a library without call numbers. And these diaries, to me, became the call numbers. And the more I read them, I'd at first been very wary about reading them because every stupid, spotty-faced thing you've done with your life is down on a piece of paper and it can be rather jarring to look back on it. But I found instead this vast recoil of memory. And could do nothing but write it down. And so again, this business of weaving, I think we have our own sense of personal myth, the things that we mythologize about our own lives. And then there's the myth that forms parts of our society. For example, I wrote a book about two men trying to beat Charles Lindbergh across the Atlantic in 1927. The story is based on a true story. These two men, the John Waynes of their day, took off, they were French, they were World War I aces, and they've been living off their reputations just a little bit too long. So they had to do one great thing, one last thing, to secure themselves immortality. And what they were going to do was fly across the Atlantic, which no one had done before. So they set off, and they disappeared, and they were never found. And I didn't know a thing about this. We all know about Lindbergh, who achieved immortality, and perhaps that was the worst thing that ever happened to him. But we don't know about the people who tried and failed. History had a way of sweeping them under the mat. And up in Maine, about several years ago, I found an old paper clipping of two chaps leaning out of the cockpit of a plane. And it was a story about how the grandson of one of these men goes back to Maine, where he believes the plane crashed, and searches for the body of his grandfather, somehow to vindicate this man. And I could not get out of my head the idea that these two men must at one point have stood on the brink of immortality and complete oblivion. Because I believe the more the research panned out, I believe that they did reach America, but I believe that they disappeared into those vast pine forests in northern Maine. And this was the grain of non-fiction. This was what mythology had chosen to ignore, what the mythology of our century had chosen to ignore, and instead to have Lindbergh heaped with all of those kudos.
To go back to your diaries for a moment, that's very interesting.
I think that the whole concept of keeping a diary is a very interesting thing, because who are you keeping it for? Are you keeping it for posterity? Are you keeping it for your grandchildren to
rummage
through? Well, or are you keeping it just to settle things in your mind? What the great comfort for me in keeping a diary was that it set everything straight at the end of the day. There was this brief summary, and then I put it behind me, and I never reread them. I never reread them until last year. And so the actual recording of events was not for the idea of saving them, was not for the flourish of the word on the page, as much as it was for me to be able to set things to rest. I find the process of writing a great process of setting things to rest, in as much as I think of it like a ladder. And through each book, it doesn't seem to matter what I'm writing about, but the sum total of everything I care greatly about, I can't help but put into whatever book I'm working on, and that becomes like a rung of the ladder.
Do you still keep a diary?
No, not anymore. I think that I stopped needing one. All through England, again, this sense of a parallel universe, belonging to two countries, as I did, meant effectively belonging to neither. And so I found myself like governor of some mid-Atlantic colony with a population of one just drifting back and forth every now and again. And what it meant was that I wasn't able to become one of the English, and nor was I able to become one of the Americans, because when I would come back, the English holidays were different than the American holidays, and part of the process of having started writing at all was because I was left alone. And as people do, you invent a world for yourself if the world around you becomes inadequate, which it did.
Well, how do you see yourself now in terms of your nationality?
Now, I think I leave it up to whoever's... What I find is that the emphasis is always on other people trying to put you in their pocket, in whichever pocket they feel most comfortable with.
Well, where do you feel most comfortable?
I find it very easy to drift back and forth from each country. I don't feel the need to be anchored in one particular place. I do think that we all have a sense of holy ground. There are places that, when things get rough for us, we return to in our minds. And I don't think those places are necessarily churches or locations, but they're places where we do feel as if we have some sense of home. And I have places like that on both sides of the Atlantic. So culturally, you can't help but be a muddle of the two. And particularly in Britain, when the culture is subdivided into these, the elite and the not elite, you find yourself, particularly at the age of leaving high school, with the horizon getting incredibly narrow rather than broader. And that was, in fact, why I left England and came to study in the States, and stayed here because I find it much easier to be a writer in this country. I think the opportunities, particularly for young writers, are almost institutionalized now with all of these writing programs. I don't say they're all a brilliant idea, but what they do is they give you time to write a plateau where writing can get done without any interference. It gives you a community and it gives you contacts. In England, it's still very much of a gentleman's sport, like fox hunting or something like that.
Well, your first novel was Night Over Day Over Night, and such a precocious start. You were, what, 22 when you published that book, right?
I was 16 when I wrote it.
Actually wrote it at 16?
I should tell you the story behind it. I was an exchange student in Germany when I was 16, and about 3 days, I was with a very strict Prussian family who had a suit of armor propped up in their living room, and everything else was this sort of high-tech black and white German things. They'd been a family from the east, from Prussia, had fled from the Russians, and the one thing, of all of the silver and the jewels and the paintings they had, the one thing they chose to take with them was a suit of armor. So that tells you a little bit about the family. 3 days before I was due to go back to England, the father brought me into a room and he said, "I'm going to tell you something." I could see he was upset. He said, "I'm going to tell you something I haven't told my own sons yet." And he rolled up his sleeve and showed me a tattoo, a blood group marking on the underside of his arm. And he had been a member of the SS when he was 16. And he only told me one anecdote, but that one anecdote stuck in my head. He told me that after 3 days of fighting in the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes Forest, that he'd gone through the woods and come to the edge of a field. By that time, his platoon of 14 had been reduced to 4, and an officer grouped him and several others together and said, "I want you to fix bayonets and advance across this field." And the officer said, "If I see anybody's face, that is, if anybody turns around," he said, "I'll shoot you myself." And so, as the father explained it to me, he said, "I started running out across this field as fast as I could, and I could see the Americans shooting at me from the tree line. And then they started laying down mortars on us, and," he said, "eventually I couldn't take it anymore, and I turned around." And he realized he was the only one left standing. He was all by himself in the field and assumed that he'd actually been shot at from both sides, so he laid down. And after about an hour, when the shooting stopped, the Americans came down and started looting the bodies. And he said he remembered being turned over and having his belt buckles stolen. And that was basically the start and the end of his war, because he was captured shortly after that. But I think he worried greatly about this great metronome of history. He had, because he had no frame of reference, he had honestly thought he was doing the right thing in becoming one of these sort of, this absolute extreme, at a time of absolute extremes. What he became was exactly the opposite.
When you wrote this book, this episode that you recount must have intrigued you to the degree that you wanted to write about someone like that and humanize that individual.
It wasn't the process, the word humanize wasn't the first one into my head. I think the idea was I just could not get out of my skull this idea that this man had basically been my surrogate father. And at a time when, you know, when I was used to being at school with no sort of parental influences at all, you were there with the other boys and that was it. The idea was to set straight in my mind how it must have felt for him, because I saw, and if one can felt, the vast confusion that had come down on this man's life. And so it was an idea to try and understand him. I think ultimately, perhaps it humanized him, but it was not a humanizing situation that he found himself in. So that's a tough call.
Now, you said you were 16 when you began this book, but you certainly at the age of 16, unless, of course, you are a precocious young man, there's no question about that, but it's very difficult for me to see how a 16-year-old could have generated this book. It must have been revised and altered over a period
certainly
of time.
Certainly it was. I think there were three rewrites. The only thing I think that's interesting about the first draft is that there are almost no corrections. When I look back on, and this is all written in fountain pen on what the English call foolscap paper, I look back and saw the book set out without revision, entirely there on the page, very few words crossed out, whereas of course now, tapping away on the computer, I can't seem to get one sentence out without revising it three or four times on the spot. There's this sense of almost being crippled by how easily things are set up for us now in technology, whereas before, I had to write by flashlight in the middle of the night. In order to get it typed out the first time, I did a boy's French homework for a month in exchange for him typing it out. So it was all very makeshift. And yes, there were plenty of revisions. But the book ended up getting published, I think, when I was 21. So I think I had a chance to write it about three times.
Was it published in England first?
No, it was published by Knopf here.
Mm-hmm. And then published in England.
And then published by Hutchinson in England.
Mm-hmm.
And Hutchinson, I then moved to Faber, and from Knopf I then moved to Random House. There's a lot of shuffling that goes on these days.
I think you stopped at Houghton Mifflin in the middle.
That's right, I had a little stop.
Well, your new book is The Promise of Light, and this one deals with Ireland and the Irish Republican Army. How did this idea pop into your mind?
There was one specific incident that made me start the research, and again, start it more for my own curiosity than specifically for a book. Part of the whole upbringing in the what they call the British public school system is military service, which I did. And during that time, we were always taught what to do when we got to Ireland, Northern Ireland, and not if. And during all that time, we were never really told why. I had no knowledge of why this whole conflict was going on, why we were there, what the reasoning was for us being there. And yet, I was taught in very great detail how to cope in a military situation when I arrived. There are entire towns made out of concrete, purely out of concrete. No windows, no doors, nothing in the rooms. Out on the fields of Salisbury Plain, this vast treeless expanse. And there you are taught what to do. And this became a very taboo subject when I came to America. It was very unpopular to mention it. And I remember saying it a couple of times that had been part of my schooling in England, and then just didn't mention it again. And I was at a New Year's Eve party a year and a half ago, and a man stood up and gave a toast to the Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. And I can remember, it was like someone stuck a knitting needle in me. I can remember thinking that if that man had said something like that in England, he would have left through the window. But it made me think, why did I react so harshly against it when I barely know what the Sinn Féin are? So I went down into the labyrinth of the Princeton Library and just started reading about it. And the more I read, the more the story wouldn't let me go, and it became a book. It's also a book about, well, the story is about a young American, the son of an Irish immigrant, whose father is injured in an accident, and after a routine blood transfusion, the son finds out that the father, the man he thought was his father, isn't his father at all, because the blood actually kills him. And because of the wrong type of blood. So he heads back to Ireland to find out the truth about his family. This is in 1921, at the time of the Irish Civil War, and becomes involved with the beginnings of the IRA.
So it's also a story about a young man's quest for his true identity.
Yes, very much so. It's a It's an idea of trying to sort out the balance between the old world and the new. And it's also a time when myth collided with reality. The only way, it seems to me, that the Irish were able to drum the people up to a point where they could throw off the British after hundreds of years of being suppressed was by calling back to their ancestral, not so much the actual ancestors as their ancestral stories, their heritage, the heritage of Cathaoirlein, the heritage of Finn MacCool. And there's one story of a knight leading, once the country had been put to peace, leading 50 of his knights into a cave, and laying them down to sleep, and then blocking the entrance of the cave, and hanging a bell from that cave, with the promise that when the country was again in trouble, they would ride out into the light and save the country again. Now, what they managed to do, the people in the 1920s, was say, now look, there are men coming down from the hills. But no, they're not the men in armor, the golden armor, who've been asleep for 1,000 years. These are men in grubby trench coats with shotguns under their arms and toothbrushes in their top pockets. And these are the people who have come to save the country. So by having that collision of myth and reality, they finally galvanized a movement. And that became very apparent to me as I went through the research.
Now, your protagonist is somewhat bewildered by everything that's going on. He's caught up against his will. He thought this was going to be a relatively simple trip to return the ashes of the man he thought was his father and to find out his true identity. He gets caught up in all of this action. He's rather even-handed about it, but I think it's apparent that the English are the heavies in this book.
Well, historically, they certainly were. And again, I'm speaking from the point of view of someone who trained with those heavies. So what happened was the British overreacted to a small amount of insurgence that was going on in the 1920s, and they sent over what were called the Black and Tans. People have heard of them. The Black and Tans were a paramilitary group wearing the black of police trousers. In Britain, the police wear black, and the army wear khaki. So you've had this Black and Tan, and they were called that because there was a local pack of hunting hounds, an Irish pack of hunting hounds that were called the Black and Tans, so they themselves were called this pack of dogs. And some of the things I read, stories of the city of Cork just blazing and blind drunk British soldiers staggering through the streets with suitcases full of money taken from banks, taken from jewelry stores. There's no doubt about it, the idea of them being heavies is no exaggeration at all.
You actually, in the mold of Graham Greene, have gone on location to research your books, haven't you? Tell me about your research in Ireland.
Oh, three or four. Well, five trips overall to Ireland, but four specifically for the research. The idea was to go... I think the difficulty of doing research is sometimes you'll set yourself an agenda of things you want to find out whether they're true or find out whether they're not. And what happens is when you get there, you find yourself blinkered. By that I mean you go to confirm what you basically already know. This is something that developed for me as over the number of trips I took. So finally, towards the end, I started going without any set agenda. I would just go and live in some small Irish town. I would allow myself to drift around with whatever became current. Whatever became most interesting to me, and I found that level of research, that to the point where it appears redundant, is where the details truly come in. I think that, I mean, sometimes it gets a little bizarre. I actually picked up clothing from the period in markets in Dublin and then later on in Ireland and hung them up on the walls. I bought a pair of old field boots. These are these knee-high leather boots that the IRA men used to wear. And the thing is that, yes, that's all very strange, until you actually see it in the book. And the thing is that if you don't know what it's like to wear these heavy waistcoats every day, to wear the, live wrapped in these trench coats, and to know how your calves hurt if you walk for any great distance in these field boots, you can't fit in the details that make the period come to life. I'm convinced it won't come off the page. So you have to go into it without any degree of embarrassment about the depth of the research. I mean, another example would be going to the Sahara to do research for the book called In the Blue Light of African Dreams, because the characters in the book had been flyers in the French Foreign Legion. And when I went to Africa, I went without much of an idea of what the Legion had done in Africa. And the strangest thing is that the most vivid piece of description that I came back with was something that I had no idea about when I arrived. Two things. One is the French word le cafard, which is C-A-F-A-R-D. It's a word to describe boredom that borders on insanity. And I spent 3 months in the Sahara and became very well acquainted with that. There's an idea. You start to think, well, first of all, you're the only white man in town except for a few people who drift back in and forth. So you're very much a stranger. You're very much a stranger culturally. You're not trusted. You don't trust them. You become utterly paranoid, just like the French soldiers did. I used to hang out in a cafe called the Café Dimitri, which was named for a member of the Russian aristocracy who had been a member of the French Foreign Legion and had opened up a cafe in the desert and had run it. And this had been his hideaway. And the more I stayed there, the more I realized that only by staying in Africa for this length of time could I come away with that sense of the kafir. And when I came to write it, I realized that I would have been shortchanging myself and therefore the reader if I hadn't come across that. The other thing is the origin of the title, which makes perfect sense when I came home to describe it, but again, it was this image which struck me strongly at the time. When you're in Morocco, you spend a lot of time in these very darkened cafes, everything made of stone, so the light doesn't come in, the heat doesn't come in. When you walk outside, which you do, you know, back and forth all the time, the light is so bright, bleaching out all of the colors outside, that your eyes seem to, while they're adjusting to the light, you see everything in a strange blue haze. It's like as if you fall asleep on the beach and wake up for a couple of seconds while your eyes get used to the light. You see in blue, and so I used to dream in this color. And as I wrote in the book, it was like having sapphires pressed against my eyes every night, through which I could remember my dreams and see them. And so the idea of research nowadays is to immerse yourself in whatever comes along, not so much this business of having like a shopping list.
You have a good eye for technical details, but you don't drop them on as heavily in the way, say, Michener does. I mean, for example, there's a lot about guns in The Promise of Light, and the technical detail about the hand grenade that the English soldiers would put around the neck of a prisoner and this sort of thing. It's there, but it's not obtrusive. And in a lot of fiction, sometimes there's an overwhelming abundance of technical detail that you can actually find in a nonfiction book. Mm. It's not really the purpose of fiction to give you for example, you could have given us gross detail about the hand grenade, but essentially you said, well, you know, you pull the pin and you wait 7 seconds or whatever it was and this sort of thing. And that was enough. Enough to intrigue me about this type of hand grenade and what they did with it, but without overwhelming me with facts.
I think that the importance of detail, for example, the first of this Irish book was something like 800 pages long, and the final draft is over 300, but it's nowhere near 800. The assumption you make when you're in the bowels of the research is that the reader has to know everything you know. And so you write it all down, and then you can tell which details will count, which details will add towards summing things up. There's always a great masochistic time in the writing process where you destroy the information you don't need. There's very rarely any time, any chance, or any reason to save it. And having a Macintosh computer as I do, you drag the little mouse thing down and down and down and down, and the screen goes black and scrolls by and scrolls by, and it's like one of those old movies where you're tearing pages off a calendar. I see weeks and weeks and weeks of work going off into outer space. And yet, it's the most necessary thing, because otherwise the effect would be to gorge the reader on that sort of detail work.
You are telling a story, after all.
Precisely. And it's not all the details that you need. You need the one detail that sums up all of the other details. I think that in the first draft, almost by necessity, you don't give the reader enough credit. One example might be in the writing of the book about Africa, I had to learn how to fly a biplane. So I found a chap who owns something called a Stearman, which is a 1930s biplane, and got him to take me up day after day, fly me around the Statue of Liberty once, take me back down to New Jersey. And I also went to the Imperial War Museum and was allowed to sit in the original planes, the Spads, the Sopwiths. But of all of those details, strangely, the ones that occur to me most from sitting in the Spad is the creak of the seat as you sit down in it, because it's wicker. And the other thing was the horsehair padded rim of the cockpit, which is then covered with leather, and I could see the sweat stains where the pilot had taken off his gloves and lifted himself out of the plane, and you could see the darkness of the sweat stains at the rims. And those details, you can't get them unless you're there, and you can't really appreciate how valuable they become until you know all the other details. So I had to study, oh God, flight manuals, all the whole business of training. I can remember I spent the entire month of August writing out this chapter of what it was like for this chapter to go through training, and realizing at the end of the month, rather sadly, that this entire chapter was going to have to get butchered, bar nothing. So it's masochistic in a way.
I used the word precocious before. You've learned a lot of literary lessons in your short career. These are lessons that sometimes people don't learn in a lifetime. Just your own perspective in terms of literature, how did it develop to be so advanced at such an early age?
Well, I don't do much else. I think that writing became something... Writing sneaked up on me. That's what it did. I would find myself writing for amusement, then amusement becomes a hobby, and then more and more you find segments of time getting pared away, and you see what's important. You see parts of socializing getting given over towards the writing. You see my classes all going in the gutter from needing to write and not really caring, realizing the importance of it. Until eventually, by the time I got to Yale, I was searching out jobs, minder jobs, where I could be night watch person and then I could write. So the idea of narrowing my life down to the point where all I was doing was writing, perhaps put it myself through some sort of crash course. For example, at Yale, I sold copy cards for Xerox machines. It's like credit cards for Xerox machines. I got the job for 2 hours a day. I would sell these copy card machines, and then after a week of doing this job, suddenly people stopped showing up. Of course, I didn't. I'd show up every day and rewrite yet another draft of my first book. And after a while, I went down to the basement of the Yale Law Library and saw that the Xerox machines were all gone. So, of course, no wonder anybody was coming by. I said to someone walking past, I said, when do the Xerox machines go? They said, oh, those little copy card things you were selling didn't work. So then I realized, like something out of a Kafka story, that I was lost in the machinery, still collecting my computer printout paychecks, still with an office with my coffee machine and my...
I'm a little confused. What are copy cards?
Copy cards are like credit cards, yeah, to be fed into a Xerox machine, right, to save you carrying around a bag of nickels. Perhaps I should have made that clear. Like a credit card, you pay $10, you get 100 copies. So that was my job.
And you sold these copy cards.
That's right.
That was your job.
For the first 2 weeks. And then people stopped showing up.
At your office.
At my little office, at the office that had been given to me.
To buy the cards, because the cards did not seem to work in the machine.
That's right. So they removed the machines, but they forgot to remove me. So it was like being in a Kafka story. So I thought, now do I do the honorable thing and turn myself in? And then I thought, wait a minute. And I realized that for my writing, this was a perfect opportunity. So for the rest of the semester, I stayed for my 2 hours a day in that office and wrote more of the book. The business of learning lessons, I think a writing program is good for that, because...
Have you taken...
Yes, I did.
Where did you start?
I went up to Syracuse, New York, and my professor up there was Tobias Wolff.
Oh, yes, I know him. I've interviewed him a couple of times.
Well, he was the one who put me in touch with the person who's now my agent, Binky Urban, over at ICM. And... What I found there was you go to one of these programs to learn what to do and what not to do. I think there's a lot of mythology, even among writers, about what writing really is. And I honestly think that it's a 9-to-5 job, just like everything else. I don't think you can sit around waiting for the muse to come fluttering down and kick you in the chops with a new idea. You find yourself letting yourself off the hook. When you're self-employed in that way, you have to invent your own kind of guilt mechanism, this little gargoyle to sit on your shoulder and keep you working. I think that writing is not this thing of wearing the right black leather jacket and smoking the right funny cigarettes or going to New York because you think the city itself will make you a writer, as if there's some Midas touch waiting to happen. I think there's another great confusion about the community of writers. People look back to the 20s and they see Hemingway, they see Fitzgerald, they see this great bog of talent sort of hedged away in Paris someplace. And the idea somehow is that when these writers got together, they fed off themselves. Well, I don't think that's... When you look back on the interviews that these people gave, the sense is much more of isolation and of the threads of these people's work coming together over a space of time, so that together they managed to find a communal voice, which in itself summed up their generation. But I see it's almost like a reverse sunburst, everything coming towards the center rather than fanning out. And I think that the work of individuals, solitary as it is, will come together in some form of theme, and that theme will do much towards summing up the literary part of that particular generation. And then as soon as that generation has a name, it will effectively be over. So it's an exciting time, because it's the end of the last decade. It took a few years to end, really, longer than it should have done, but now there's a great sense of the wave having broken, and some people didn't ride out that wave, and now the air's clean again. There's a sense of what will come of this decade, and it's an exciting time to be working at this sort of field.
Yeah, I know you're living in Princeton. What do you do there when you're not writing?
I teach two seminars. I teach one at a school called Lawrenceville and another one at a school called Petty. I go in there and sweat a lot and say outrageous things. It's a class about discipline. I don't think writing can be taught. I think that the discipline behind it can be.
These are prep schools?
That's right. It's 18-year-olds. Very humbling experience. These are people with the energy of adults, but the enthusiasm of children. So it keeps me on my toes.
Well, Paul Watkins, your new book is not only a moving story of a young man's quest, but a very exciting story, too, about a very dramatic period in history, the promise of light. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.